everybody, and thank you for joining this special episode of New Jersey Revolution Radio. We pay tribute to Kevin Zeis with three of his appearances. The first one on January 30th, 2019, where he joined us on a special panel on Venezuela. On March 21st, 2019, when he reported back after he visited Venezuela with other members of the U.S. Peace Council delegation. And on May 29th of that same year, 2019, for another panel called The U.S. War Empire.
So this evening, we have Kevin Zeis with us. He is the co-director of Popular Resistance. And most recently, he co-authored an article. It's Venezuela, What Activists Need to Know About the U.S.-Led Coup. We have Christian Perez with the podcast Modernity and Absurdity. He is an adjunct professor of political science. We have Miguel Patino. He is a member of the Colombian Human Rights Network. This evening, he will be speaking as his capacity as a member of the Colombian Grassroots Support. And he is an attorney and longtime political activist from Colombia.
Right.
So thank you so much for being with us this evening. I know there is so much propaganda out there about what's going on in Venezuela, and there is, you know, maybe accessible to our viewers only about, you know, a very small handful of news sources that we have to dig through and comb through to try to find out what's really going on. So that's why we wanted to do this panel this evening, to give our viewers, hopefully, you know, propaganda free. I know we're all propaganda free. propaganda free news about what is really going on. So to start, if, you know, we want to talk about the timeline, about what got, how did Venezuela get to where we are today, where we are looking at the very serious possibility that U.S. was involved with an attempted coup. Kevin, I know you're in your article, you gave a good timeline. So do you want to give us some information on...
Sure. I can give it a try. I mean, this has been an ongoing coup really since Hugo Chavez was elected. But what happened recently was last year, President Maduro won re-election in a very legitimate election, no matter what you hear in the media. He won with 67% of the vote, 48% of the people voted. The claim of illegitimacy comes from the opposition because the opposition boycotted the election. So they said, since we boycotted it and had 46% of the people showing up, which is not too bad compared to U.S. elections, that makes it illegitimate. But in fact, there were election observers. I was an election observer down there. I was in Venezuela for election day. And there's no question it was a legitimate election. But this crisis really begins with Donald Trump in mid-2017 talking about a military attack on Venezuela, a war on Venezuela. And he was very clear about the oil that Venezuela has. And John Bolton's very clear about that as well. And since then, he's been talking to Latin American leaders and his cabinet about what we can do about Venezuela. With the election of Maduro, again, a six-year term, they really had to figure out what to do. And they've been looking for a way to do a coup. His previous Secretary of State, Tillerson, did a regime change tour before he was left office. His current Secretary of State did a tour as well. Urging regime change, and they have been urging the people of Venezuela to rise up, the military take over. And they finally found someone who will willing to take the job. The guy, Guaido, has been a long-term project of U.S. regime change. He was educated at George Washington University under a former IMF lead banker, Venezuelan economist. But NEDs had their money into him as well. They've been working on him for 10 years. He's a legislator no one had heard of. He's from the second smallest state. He only got about 20% of the vote in the legislative race. And the National Assembly, which is in contempt of court because of its illegality, we can go into that later, appointed him as president. And he accepted the nomination, self-appointed him as president. The night before that, Mike Pence called him, said, "We'll support you." The day before that, Mike Pence put a video out urging people to do an uprising, urging the military to support a coup. As soon as he announced he was president, President Trump, within minutes, recognized him as president. U.S. allies in Latin America, conservative governments did the same. Some European governments as well. It was a well-orchestrated coup, aggressive social media, a mass protest. And even though he had a month working on this protest, the protest in support of Maduro was bigger because the population supports Maduro. And when there's, even though it's criticism of Maduro, he's not perfect. Even though it's, when there's an attack by U.S. imperialism, it unifies everybody around the government. They might have criticism of Maduro, but they like U.S. imperialism even less.
And so the evidence, because we're not really hearing much in our mainstream news, and you know, I'm glad you touched on that the Maduro protests were even larger than the opposition protests, because we're not seeing that in the news.
No, you're not. Yeah. If you look at the faces in the opposition protests, they're mainly white and they're definitely well-off people. They still have that small group of people who are upper middle class and wealthy behind the opposition. They can't win elections. Mm-hmm. And that's why they tried to boycott the presidential election. They knew they were going to lose anyway. Maduro got 67% of the vote. Henry Falcon, the opposition candidate, got about 20%. There were six candidates in the race. Maduro won it easily and would have won it whether it was a boycott or not, and they knew that. So they tried to delegitimize the election by not voting. Mm.
And so why? Why is the U.S. government doing this? You touched on it a little bit, and I don't know, Christian, you're nodding your head. What would you
say? I would say primarily it's oil, right? We know it's oil. 95% of the Brazilian economy, I'm sorry, Brazilian, Jesus, Venezuelan economy is based on oil. They have billions of dollars in other resources still in the soil, underneath the ground in Venezuela. I mean, the problem isn't the wealth. The problem is, as was stated before, is that Venezuela doesn't really have anybody to sell their goods to, right? Mm-hmm. The United States is locking them out with sanctions. That's unfortunate. I'm not going to die on the hill of defending Maduro. I don't think that's what the issue is. We can spend another day criticizing Maduro, but we know that this is a coup. Really quick, one of the things I wanted to touch on about the opposition protests is I don't think it's always fair to call them protests. I mean, we can go back in the history. We could look at the violence perpetrated by the opposition. We're talking about warehouses filled with food earmarked for schools being stolen, the burning of veterinary hospitals, the burning of actual hospitals, attacks on public transport. There are reports of Maduro supporters being sniped at.
That's right.
People being shot in the face with shotguns. This is not these are not the protests we're seeing in D.C. This is not the same tame, you know, struggle that we're seeing. We're seeing a cleverly orchestrated disinformation campaign on behalf of the international status quo. I mean, you can call it capitalism, you can call it the West, but that's what it is. The big crime of Venezuela is the crime of Vietnam, right? It's the crime of wanting to run your country the way you see fit, and that's just unacceptable to some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was really impressed with reading Kevin's article about the fact that over in Venezuela, they seem to have more democracy than we do with the election system, the way the protections and the audits that are unheard of in the U.S. So,
and around the world.
Around the world. So they have an excellent system in place. And you know, like you were saying, I guess it sounds like the opposition pulled out because if they stayed in the election, then they couldn't claim that it was an illegitimate election, that there was fraud. So they had to pull out, correct? Is that
exactly? No, in fact, the United States pressured them to pull out. The United States was very angry at Falcon for running. They would have preferred not to have had Falcon run. And I was amazed at the election day for a number of things. First off, the right to vote is in the Constitution. We don't have that. And that changes a lot. Once you have a right to vote, then you, election officials look at, are there enough machines? Are there enough precincts? And they actually react to long lines and lack of machines and change that for the next election. But what was really impressive was at the end of election day, on the end of the day, election days are long and hard. They do a audit, what they call a people's audit, where 52% of the machines at every precinct are audited. They have a paper ballot and the electronic ballot. They empty out the paper ballots, and in public, they read ballot for Maduro, ballot for Falcone, and they go through every ballot, and they count them all. All the opposition parties are there to see it. They show the ballot to everybody. It's on video by the Election Commission. So it's a public audit of 52% of the machines on Election Day. And then they compare the paper ballot, which the voters have verified when they voted, with the electronic ballot. And if there's no problem, fantastic. The electronic machines work. And so that's something no other country does. Jimmy Carter called it the best election system in the world.
Wow.
I want to add one point about the oil, because it's really, this is really important.
Okay.
Both China and Russia are part owners of that oil. For the loans they have given Venezuela, because the U.S. has shut down finance, Venezuela went to China, Russia, and other nations and got loans. And part of that loan was they got a piece of the action of the oil and the gold. Venezuela is number one in oil in the world reserves, number two in gold reserves. And they have all these minerals that are essential for electronics. And so when you're attacking Venezuela's oil, when the U.S. is attacking Venezuela's oil, they're also attacking Russia and China. And Russia has a battalion of troops in Venezuela. They have military equipment in Venezuela, including bombers. And they've told the United States, don't intervene militarily. So it's a this is a global geopolitical conflict. And it's, so it's about oil and controlling the backyard of the United States, the Monroe Doctrine. This is a time for the Monroe Doctrine to end. And this is a gigantic error by Trump. He's going to be regretting the mess he's getting the United States into here.
And where are we at now? Because I understand the opposition was Guaido was trying to get the military to intervene and assist, but right now they're supporting Maduro, correct?
Yeah, there was a handful of officers that decided to rise up. It wasn't much, and they were already arrested and put down. The military has come out in support of the Maduro government.
Okay, so now I guess the scary thing is that we're hearing more and more that if it's, you know, if we're trying to pull the strings from within Venezuela and it's not happening, what are potentially the next steps, which we could talk about John Bolton's, you know, hashtag yellow memo pad and his 5,000 troops to Colombia, which Miguel, you have your background and connections in Colombia. So how do you see this playing out and Colombia's involvement?
Okay, unfortunately, now these two countries, Colombia and Venezuela, that always have been very good brothers since the foundation of the nation 2 centuries ago, they were just one big country called La Gran Colombia. And Simón Bolívar was the founder father of these countries. There had been very long story of a good relation between the countries, despite some borders issues. Example was there was some dispute about the sovereignty in the Gulf of Maracaibo. We were talking in the 70s, they were talking about the possibility to a conflict because Colombia was disputing some territory there. But this situation, now Colombia is United States trying to use Colombia as a military foot to invade Venezuela. We are really concerned because this can become the Latin American Vietnam. And the situation is that in this moment, no by John Bolt means that the military presence of the United States in Colombia is going to increase. At the peak of the military presence of the United States in Colombia was in the year 2000. There were more or less 1,000 contractors and military members. But by after that, little by little, there was decreasing that number. And in 2014 was maybe around 100. But now we are talking about approximately 800 military contractors between military personnel and military contractors. This is gonna be increased with this. They are increasing the presence since year 2017. And in this moment, United States has a presence with this military personnel in near 9 military bases in Colombia. One is the air base Palanquero in the Magdalena Medio, in the Plains, the API military base, the Navy bases. There is military personnel from the United States. And the United States has 51 buildings with a value of $22 million in Colombia. So the situation is that people in power now in Colombia, the ruler class, are really extreme right-wing politicians, and they agreed to be used as a tool by the United States to invade Venezuela. And we are thinking that they are gonna do it to not in the Caribbean, because there is presence of military vessels from Russia in the Margarita Island. So they are thinking maybe to do these actions, military actions, to the Amazonian border. Colombia and Venezuela have very long border in the Amazonians. And they're trying to use Peru, Brazil, troops from Peru, Brazil, and Colombia to create military conflicts in that region in Venezuela and disseminate the conflict.
Yeah, and I was going to touch on, you know, who are the allies on each side and who are the, the opposition, with the right wing, increasing right wing governments in South America. So right now we would have Colombia would be supportive of the opposition, Guaido. Brazil, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, absolutely.
Chile?
Chile, for sure. There's a group called the Lima Group. There's a group called the Lima Group that makes up of a lot of Latin American countries who are right-wing countries. But the interesting thing is the Organization of American States, which is usually very controlled by the United States, tried to pass a resolution to recognize Guaido and failed. They could only get 16 votes, less than a majority of the members of the OAS to support that. So that's a very positive sign.
Yeah.
Now, Colombia, I think, well described Colombia's military footprint there. And I essentially see Colombia as the Israel for the United States in Latin America. They are, you know, ever since Plan Colombia and the militarization of Colombia, Uribe and the right-wing control of the government, it's gotten to be more and more of an Israel for the United States. Does the dirty work. And in fact, if you look at the 2002 coup of Chavez that lasted for 48 hours, the president of that coup, when he was forced out of office, fled to Colombia.
Pedro Carmona.
That's right. The recent assassins, when there was an assassination attempt, the reports are they were trained in Colombia. And so Colombia is very involved in this, and Colombia is a very important player. And now, of course, Brazil,
on the southern border. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. has done military drills with these groups as well. So this is U.S. has been building toward this for a long time, but it would be a big mistake because Venezuela has a military of 20,000 troops. They have a National Guard and police. But when these threats of military attacks started to develop, Maduro created civilian militias.
Yep.
1.5 million people trained as militias. 1.5 million people armed and trained, 20,000 military plus police and National Guard. This is not an easy battle for the United States, Colombia, and Brazil. So they're going to have to think very carefully. It's not going to be a cakewalk, a simple victory for Trump to say I'm a great commander-in-chief. It'll be a mess. And it'll be, in the end, with Russia and China on the side of Venezuela, we're going to see, if it goes that far, and I hope it doesn't, we will see the result of Syria where Russia defeats the United States again.
Really quick, if I could jump in. I mean, sure. We're looking at this in the context of Donald Trump with a 30% approval rating. That's in the true. Context of 45% of Republicans saying that the Russians have something on Donald Trump. Okay, so I mean, Donald Trump is looking for a distraction. He's always looking for a distraction. He's getting slapped around about this wall. He's not the great deal breaker. It just came out that North Korea, big surprise, isn't gonna disarm like anybody actually thought that was gonna happen. But yeah. There was this minute there for a couple weeks where I kind of forgot that I was living on planet Earth. I was watching CNN. I was reading the New York Times, and I was absolutely loving the mainstream media kind of tee off on Trump. And I think anybody wanting to call the mainstream media left wing really needs to look at this Venezuela situation. I was watching the World News, was it David Muir, ABC, an hour ago with my wife, and they referenced these militias in Venezuela. And the term they used was the feared militias of Venezuela. The reason these people are armed, the reason you have a militia is to protect the state from the military. Right, because they know that there's definitely a chance that the military can turn. If that's the case, the people themselves are armed. Furthermore, I also heard, you know, you've got the
I think they're armed because of the fear of invasion by U.S. Colombia.
That's definitely a big part of it. Yeah, the people need to be armed. I mean, Latin America. I mean, really quick, I keep this book here to remind myself of where I came from, Killing Hope by William Bloom. It's the book that radicalized me as a freshman. Anybody that wants to put this coup, and it is a coup, and I'll keep saying that, anybody that wants to put this coup in the proper context can check out William Bloom's Killing Hope. It is probably the best book on the subject, and large parts of it are available for free.
That's right.
Cool. Open sourcing. Yeah. So I guess how real is the threat of U.S. military intervention? And I know I heard
How stable is Donald Trump today? How stable is he going to be tomorrow?
And some are talking.
I think that's exactly right. Donald Trump is the problem. I mean, Donald Trump is floundering in the polls. He's under attack.
And that's
the biggest. But I think the Pentagon and the intelligence authorities don't want a war in Venezuela. They can look and see what's happening, and they don't want to go there. When Trump has suggested this in the past, his generals in his cabinet thought he was crazy, and they were very open about saying that's nuts. So that's the battle. Will the foreign policy establishment stop Trump from going forward? Will Trump be told enough information about what he's getting into to realize this would be a mess that would be a negative on his reputation, not a problem.
I think he gets told the information. I just don't think he's paying attention to
it. That's a big problem.
Yeah. He's 2 years into his administration. He has terrible approval ratings. So he doesn't have his own war yet. He took over the GW and Obama wars, but he doesn't have his own war. So this is, you know, the possibility of a real threat, depending on, you know, who he gets angry at on Twitter.
And he's removed those generals who were saying no.
Yeah.
You know, they're replaced by Bolton, Pompeo, and
Elliot Abrams,
who approved the coup against Chavez.
He covered up the massacre at El Mozote.
He's a war criminal.
Yeah, he's a war criminal. I mean, we're talking about I don't even say women, children as young as 10 years old being systematically raped en masse. reports of babies being impaled on bayonets. All the horrors of the Cold War have taken place in Central America, in Latin America, fully funded, fully supported by the U.S. government. And surprise, Elliot Abrams, he's back.
A major player, and we're bringing him back in because we haven't had enough. We haven't had a recent coup. We haven't had recent enough chaos for especially not for this administration. So this is, he really sounds, like he's a very intelligent man, but he sounds like he's...
Oh, he's very intelligent.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
And from the stories that you were just saying, and I've been doing some looking up, the way he accepts the role of what had to take place and somewhat acknowledging it, but saying, it was what had to be done.
Yeah, brown people wanted to decide.
Like we're getting close to evil when, you're talking about children and, the brutality of what was done to, just genocide.
That's why what you're doing on this show is so important, and why it's so important for people who care about peace and justice to get informed about this and not be fooled by the bipartisans in Washington, D.C., because both parties are complicit, not be fooled by the corporate media, which is part of this, the charade, this false narrative, and know what's really going on and come out and say, no, U.S. out of Venezuela, end the sanctions, end the threats of war.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I did want to touch on what can we do? I feel helpless when you see, the past history of what's gone on and what this looks like is about to unfold. What do we do? What do our viewers do?
Well, I'm not convinced it's going to unfold. I mean, I think we can stop.
Okay.
I think we can stop it. Let's not start from a self-defeated position. It's Trump is, not predictable, not stable, and under a lot of pressure, and could do something very stupid. But I think we have a lot of power at our fingertips. I mean, we can change the narrative. And I've seen so much good writing on Venezuela, so much good analysis on Venezuela. I think it's our job, everyone listening to this, and for us to go, when we see positive, clear thinking, share it, comment on it, share it with politicians. Let politicians know we know the truth. Let them know. How can you say it wasn't a fair election? We had 150 international observers at the Venezuelan election. They all said it was a fair election. Give me a break. It's an outright lie. How can we say that Venezuela is being violent against nonviolent protesters? The evidence is clear, as was said. The protesters were violent, extremely violent.
Yeah.
They tried to fool people. So the facts are clear against what the U.S. is doing. Our job as activists is to change the narrative, get the truth out, so they can't get away with this.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And, we have a couple of progressive Dems that are out there in opposition. So I guess we have to influence our representatives.
Yeah.
And I know, what's that?
So like Bob Menendez, the guy who supports the Cuban embargo. I mean, I don't understand how he could be considered this great Latino leader when
he's not.
His career is built on the suffering of Latino people, right?
That's right.
I'm sure he's doing great things for immigrants in New Jersey, but he's a Latino and he's a politician. He should be doing that anyway, right? Mm-hmm. I was raised to believe you don't get rewarded for doing what you're supposed to do. And, helping people out. Yeah, that's what you're supposed to do. That's your job as a politician. But supporting that embargo in Cuba is vicious. And those are his people. He's a Cuban. He's a Cuban exile, right? And now he wants to do the same thing with Venezuela, right? Yeah. With Democrats like these, who needs Republicans?
Yeah.
We have to start demanding that Congress take responsibility. Under the Constitution, they have the power to declare war. The president cannot unilaterally do this.
Yeah.
And I think we have to start demanding of members of Congress that they insist that Trump come to Congress so we can debate this as a nation. That way we can make sure the facts get out. I mean, we have a corporate media that will try to overwhelm us, but we have a much bigger media, and we have a much more credible media. The social media has more credibility and reaches more people than the corporate media does. So we should insist on Congress requiring the president to come
to Congress before any military action is taken. There's no need for urgent military action. We're not under attack by Venezuela. It's not a defensive attack. It's an offensive effort. And Congress needs to be involved in that. They need to be. And if they do, then we can influence Congress like we did when Obama tried to go into Syria. We stopped him. We stopped him because Congress said, we're going to vote on this. People influenced their members of Congress. He couldn't get the support.
Yeah.
So we got to do the same thing with this. We got to say no, and we got to insist that Congress play its role.
Yeah.
I just want to add something, one more thing really quick. And I said this last time I was on your show, Diane, and again, thanks for having me. But again, just keep this in your back pocket. Mm-hmm. Anytime Donald Trump is supposed to be the good guy, that should set up a red flag.
Yeah.
If Donald Trump is talking about democracy and freedom, all right, let's find out what he's really trying to say, right? He supports the bombing in Yemen. He supports the fascists in Brazil. He was indifferent to Puerto Rico. He's indifferent to Mexicans. He's gassing Central American children, right? Like, come on, he's not the good guy. And he's the president of the United States. And I hate to say that as an educator, but it's the truth.
That's right.
Yeah. I just want to say, don't forget that the direct military intervention of the United States is the last resource.
That's right. And
what the United States is trying to do is do it indirectly, using on other countries. Troops, more or less the same number of troops that John Ball riding his yellow notepad.
Notepad.
5,000 troops from Brazil, from, you know, who is in power in Brazil, in Peru, and from Peru and from Colombia.
That's right.
So, just keep in mind that we need also raise solidarity and somehow, I don't know, also make hear our voice on the United Nations and other international organisms that have some voice in this conflict.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So even if we're not bringing our own troops in, we will be influencing Colombia and,
yes,
and Brazil and assisting and doing whatever else we can do to make it worth their while, I guess. Do you see that unfolding as a problem, a serious?
And I think this doesn't depend only or exclusively from Donald Trump. 2 days ago, the commander of the South Command in Florida, the general from the United States, was in Bogota. He was visiting Bogota, and he was discussing frontier issues with the Colombian government. But the real truth is they were cooking how intervene in Venezuela.
In Venezuela.
So this is really serious, and it's not just, it doesn't depend only from Trump. I think this is policy from the United States political system.
That's very true. You know, in Southcom, the head of Southcom has gone to Bogota and other cities in Colombia multiple times to talk about border security and Venezuela and regime change. In fact, there was before the last presidential election, there was a whole peace negotiation between Venezuela and Colombia, and they were coming to the point of everything agreed to and signed. But on the day it was supposed to be signed, Colombia backed out. The U.S. was in the offices in Colombia with the president when they decided to back out. So, yes, the United States does use Colombia as a pawn. Now, so far, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've read so far is both Colombia and Brazil have been urged to use military force in Venezuela, but both have so far said no to the United States.
That's
what I've read so far.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking I don't know how realistic it is, and I hope it doesn't happen. But we're looking at something worse than Vietnam, because this is something that's connected to us land-wise, right? And piggybacking on what the other gentleman said, as long as the United States stays out of it. You know, as long as the U.S. military stays directly out of it. Let me clarify that. It's not about Yankee imperialism. Right. The second the U.S. gets involved, it's all right. We're all fighting against the Yankees. As if it's the Brazilians and the Colombians invading Venezuela, I don't think it'll have that same unifying effect. I mean, it will in Venezuela. I don't know what other countries will do.
Yeah, I think that the political leadership in Brazil and Colombia even though they won elections in Colombia, the left candidate did better than expected. In Brazil, they had to do a whole lot to make sure that Lula didn't run in order to win that election. So they're not that strong. They're not that politically strong, really. And if they get involved in a war in Venezuela, that's the kind of thing that destroys governments.
And especially weak governments.
That's right. There'll be internal conflict in Colombia and Brazil about that. So it's not a simple decision for either of those countries to go forward. So the U.S. is going to put a lot of pressure on to get those countries to make that mistake.
When we hear that these countries are supporting the coup in Venezuela, we have to know that this isn't the entirety of the country,
right? That's
right.
That's right.
The wealthy elites in these countries, backed by the United States, these are the lackeys. I mean, just now in Spain, right? The Spanish came out and supported the coup. No, it wasn't the Spain. The major opposition party, Podemos, just came out with a statement saying that they don't support the coup.
That's right.
So, like, again, listening to the lies of the mainstream media, we know that this support isn't as monolithic as they want us to believe. They want us to think that support for the coup is monolithic, and that's not the case. And that's something we need to keep telling ourselves because we see it in the media constantly.
Very good point. I think you can't forget that OAS vote.
Yeah.
OAS is a tool of the United States. And for them not to be able to pass this in the OAS was pretty astounding. And so I think it's a good sign. I mean, it was 16 votes against it, for it, and 18 against it. So it was not it was close. But still, the fact that they were able to stop it is a very positive sign. And if any country looks at Venezuela carefully, sees those big militias, sees those military National Guard and police, and recognizes that Maduro got 67% of the vote, 9 million people out of a population of 30 million. This is not a cakewalk for any country to go into Venezuela.
Yeah.
And so it's a dangerous decision for anyone to make.
Yeah. It will not be an easy regime change right now. It's not. So more to come, and we will see how this unfolds. But I know there is the hands off Venezuela movement. You know, locally there's protests and calling your representatives. So we have to do that. We have to share the unpropagandized news with each other and help each other out. And yeah, I guess I would just ask you guys, closing notes. I know we covered a lot in a little bit of time, and we could go on so much further. But Kevin, do you want to give us your closing?
Well, I think that we have a role to play. This is not an easy. This is not going well for the administration. They didn't win the coup. It's an attempted coup that so far has failed. The military and the people of Venezuela are against the coup. There's dissent in the United States. We can stop this from going forward. And our goal is not just to stop the military attack, but to end these sanctions. So I think people need to get active and feel like we can actually have an impact.
Yeah, that's true. This has been going on for years. So this is just something that's becoming very heated. But the sanctions have been a problem. So we need to become more aware of what's going on now that this is coming to light.
That's right.
Thank you. And Christian, closing remarks.
Yeah, I mean, so piggybacking on what you three said, I mean, we need to be firm in our commitment that the United States needs to keep its hands off of Venezuela. We need to arm ourselves with the facts, and we need to get active, right? We need to remember democracy is a verb. It's not a noun. We need to talk to people. We need to talk to our friends, get on social media, educate ourselves, and get the word out there.
Right.
Absolutely. Yep. We have the numbers, so we have to use those numbers, right?
Yes, right. Absolutely.
We can stop this.
We can. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. I hope we helped our viewers get some propaganda-free news about what is actually going on in Venezuela. And everybody, keep up the good work on getting real information out. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Okay. Thank you all for watching.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Hi, everyone. It's Diane Moxley with New Jersey Revolution Radio. This evening, we have with us some of the members of the delegation that just got back from a trip their trip to Venezuela, and we're going to have a report back. So this evening we have with us Joe Lombardo. Joe Lombardo with the United National Anti-War Coalition. We have Margaret Flowers, one of the co-directors of Popular Resistance, with Kevin Zeese, the other co-director of Popular Resistance. So thanks so much for being with us this evening, guys. When did you get back?
We all have different answers.
It was a little complicated returning. So I got back first Sunday morning.
I got back second Monday afternoon.
And Joe?
I got back a couple hours ago. I was the last one out of Venezuela.
The problem was American Airlines canceled all their flights because of the civil unrest.
It was too dangerous.
And the high risk of Americans being arrested at any moment for no reason. All lies, of course. But they stopped their flights, and that caused a lot of confusion for our exit.
But it is one of the little things that the U.S. and the U.S. companies do to make life a little bit harder for all the people in Venezuela. So everybody had to scramble for seats on other planes that had reservations or seats on American, which is the main U.S. Airline that goes into Caracas. And it just makes it more difficult, and that's what they're trying to do.
Wow. I didn't realize you guys were that scattered in your flights.
Well, it wasn't intentional. We actually did a video the day that American Airlines announced this cancellation, walking through the streets of Venezuela to show the civil unrest. Families walking in a beautiful sunshine day, having ice cream, hot dogs, kids. There was no civil unrest at all. Venezuela was very calm and very collected. There was no problem. It was total false information by the U.S. government and American Airlines.
Wow, and they grounded all of their flights, American
Stopped
Airlines.
Stopped them all completely, yeah.
Yeah, it was the same, right around the same time that the U.S. diplomats were expelled from Venezuela, and so the State Department put out this thing saying, anybody who's there from the United States, you're on your own now. And they tried to make it sound really scary, but we were never scared.
Wow, well, sorry you guys had a lot of bumps in the road, not due to civil unrest, yeah.
Well, if that hadn't happened, we would not have met with President Maduro, because his meeting was scheduled after many of us were leaving. And because it was delayed, we actually got 10 of our members of our delegation, at least, were able to meet with President Maduro for 90 minutes in a private meeting. So we can thank American Airlines and the U.S. government for that meeting.
For helping that happen. Wow. So who organized this delegation to Venezuela? Were there a sponsoring organization or two that?
It was organized by the U.S. Peace Council. And the U.S. Peace Council is part of an organization known as the World Peace Council. And they have affiliate organizations in many different countries. So they had the capability of doing this. And in particular, they have a relationship with a group called COSI, which stands for Committee Solidarity, International Solidarity Committee. And they acted as our host, provided translators and got us places to stay and acted as our host while we were there.
Okay. And how many people were in your delegation?
There were 13 people from the United States total.
Okay.
And Canada.
And Canada. Oh, thank you. Two were from Canada. That's right.
Okay. And I know we had a good amount of our Green Party, a good amount of Greens were in the delegation. What other organizations were in the delegation?
There was the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the International Action Center, Black Alliance for Peace, Ajama Baraka, another notable Green, was there. The Women Against Military Madness from Minneapolis. Yeah. And then from Canada was a Canadian Peace Congress and Eva Bartlett, who's an independent journalist from Canada, and also Veterans for Peace. Who am I leaving out, Joe?
That's a pretty good list.
I think you got it all.
All right.
Okay. And so how long were you guys there? I know the trip got extended, but and you had some bumps in the road even on your arrival to Venezuela, correct?
Good.
Yeah, we arrived when the U.S. Created blackout was happening. And that gave American Airlines an excuse not to fly to Venezuela. So on the way down, we had to change our flights again and go through Copa Airlines through Panama. So, American Airlines canceled their flights, but other airlines were flying in. So we got to Venezuela, the blackout was happening. It was actually a really good time. I'm glad we got there for the blackout so we could see how the Venezuelan government and people responded to the blackout, because I think it was a very impressive response. They really showed unity. They took care of each other. The government made sure that food was delivered, that water was available, because when the blackout happened, and it happened because of multiple U.S. attacks, cyber attack, electromagnetic attacks, and physical attacks in Venezuela, the government was able to work hard to get that fixed quickly. They increased their bus transit because the metro, the subway was out in Caracas. The water pumps were out, so they had to provide water. People had to walk with buckets to get water to bring home, either to drink or for just, you know, toilet and other purposes. And then same food. Food had to be delivered. Then luckily, Venezuela has a really excellent food distribution program, the CLAP, that each month gives food out to 6 million people at a very low price. They have boxed foods that last 2 weeks or a month, depending on the community. And they're a very low price. We calculated the price to be about the price of a cup of coffee.
No, even less. Like
less than a cup of
coffee. A third of a penny or something like that.
So it was a token amount of money, but they provide a lot of food to people. 6 million families get those clap boxes each month.
On a regular basis.
The other thing that was important was when there's blackouts in the United States, sometimes we see rioting. People have access to goods that they normally don't. Sure. We didn't see that rioting there. We heard that there was some that was really instigated by the so-called opposition at another part of the country, but there was nothing like that. It was just cooperation among people to help people out during this period. And the other thing I like to compare it to is when, after the hurricane hit Puerto Rico, it took the United States 11 months to get the electricity back. And in Venezuela, they got it back very quickly. And when the power went out in Puerto Rico, nobody even talked about invading the United States. But we're using that as an excuse to say, you see how terrible the government is? We have to do something about it.
Yeah, the impressive thing I'd say about that, I asked people in Venezuela, why was there no looting? Why was there no chaos? And they said two things. One, they said deep education on imperialism and revolutionary change. A lot of education. It's constant. We saw that education while we were there. We can talk about that, too. It's actually the kind of education they do. But second, organization. Because they are not just a representative democracy, they're also a participatory democracy. Mm. Many communities have what are called community councils. 200 households can get together and form a community council that has general assemblies and decides what they need for the community, and then they apply to the federal government for funds to make it happen. On top of the community councils, there are communes, multiple councils coming together, trying to also improve their communities. So having that infrastructure in place of organized communities and educated communities is why I think there was such a calm and unified response to this electrical crisis. The U.S. wanted a crisis. They wanted an excuse to intervene, but the Venezuelan people knew that and didn't give them that opportunity.
That's great. That's great. So they have a sense of community that we don't have here in the U.S. We, you know, we just come and go, get in our cars, go to work, get in the house, don't really talk to your neighbors. So that's beautiful that not only do they have a sense of community, but they're actually involved in governing their local areas. That's great. And I'm sure that builds the sense of community. They're working together on a regular basis.
Of course, in the United States, we call that hyper-democracy dictatorship. when in reality, Maduro was legitimately elected in the best-run elections in the world, really. Jimmy Carter said that, and I was there for that election. They are very well-run. And so it's not a dictatorship at all. He's a legitimate, democratically elected president. He's not an authoritarian, quite restrained, actually. If he was authoritarian, Guaido would be in prison right now because he's obviously committing treason.
Yeah, that's true. You know, they thank God, you know, nothing has happened to Guaido, because I'm sure that Maduro would be to blame in Maduro's government. He's not in jail. And yeah, if we could talk a little bit about Guaido, that they use the phrase that he's the self-appointed president. So if you guys want to touch on that, how did he come to even dare self-appoint himself, even though we know this is some kind of screwy manipulation that doesn't even exist in their constitution? What's his argument, and then our government's argument for how we can recognize him as president?
Joe, well, you want to take that?
Yeah. I mean, the way he became president is he got in front of a microphone and announced himself president. Nobody voted for him to be president. Mm-hmm. And the person they did vote for was Maduro. And during that election, of course, they had a higher percentage of the electorate voting than we had in our last presidential election. And of course, our president didn't get the majority, but he got almost 70%. Mm. But I guess because he got a majority, they don't consider it valid. Mm. But he was he wasn't really, but he at a point became or claimed to be the speaker of the National Assembly. And the way that happens is basically it's a rotating position among the main parties that were in power. And his time wasn't there to be in that position, but he kind of jumped ahead of some of the other people and then proclaimed himself president. Now, their constitution has a way in which the head of the National Assembly can proclaim themselves president, in the very same way that our constitution does, or in a similar way. In other words, if the president dies and the vice president is not possible because he's either dead or incapacitated, or if they're incapacitated and could not do it, there's a few reasons like that where the head of our house would become the president. And they have a similar thing. But none of that other criteria came into being. I mean, the president was still there. He was clearly capable of continuing, but they tried to say that he wasn't. And that gave them the excuse for Guaido to call himself president. And immediately, the U.S. Recognized him, because this was a tactic that was designed in Washington, not in Caracas. However, he's lost a lot of credibility, and we saw that very, very clear. The last a couple of demonstrations that the opposition tried to make happen in Caracas really fizzled. They did not happen. Mm. I think the reason for that was the demonstration before that where he spoke, which was also a smaller demonstration. He actually called, imagine a president of a country, he called for the United States to invade his country. So imagine a president calling for another country to invade his country. And when questioned about this by the media, they said, you know, a bomb doesn't know if it's hitting someone in the opposition or a Chavista. And he said, well, yeah, but we got to expect some collateral damage to fight for democracy. And I think that caused a lot of people to really see who he is. So there was a lot of talk that maybe the vice presidential candidate, quote unquote, the vice president in his administration, who's the head of a bigger party than his. His is an extremely right-wing, small party. Mm. Wanted to come in, and people said, well, maybe he's better to the American powers as a martyr than he is as someone to try to claim to be president, because he's not doing a very good job. And everything since the coup attempt on February 23rd and the trying to get people to desert from the military and trying to get over this fake Trojan horse aid from the United States on the 23rd, and everything since that he's done has really failed. And even it was very clear that the blackout, they thought maybe this would cause people to rebel against Maduro. Mm-hmm. But it was very clear that people understood what it was, and that it just stoked the anger towards him and towards his American handlers. And so he's not a president in that country by any means. He controls nothing. It's the Maduro government that controls all the agencies and has the allegiance of all the organizations of people's power and decides what to do and what not to do and has the police and the courts and the military and everybody else are part of the Maduro government. He has no control and no influence at all in that country. It's outside where he has the influence. He's important to them in the United States. So the United States says, well, we're going to give our money to him because he's the legitimate president. And U.S. allies can say, we're going to recognize him because he's the U.S. president. But the Venezuelan people don't recognize him that way at all. It's a joke. And at the first press conference we held while we were there, one of our members from Vets for Peace, just as a joke, proclaimed himself president of the United States, because that's all that really Guaido did, you know. And it was clear it was a joke. And people, it is the subject of jokes.
Did he ask Maduro to recognize him as president of the United States?
No. And I think it's important to understand that the National Assembly, which he is a member of, is actually a defunct organization right now. They're in contempt of the Supreme Court of Venezuela, so it's not even a functioning body. And he's somebody, again, who comes from a very small party. I think he didn't even come in first in his election. So he's not a powerful person at all, but he is absolutely a tool of the United States. He was made by and for the United States. He studied at George Washington University, Washington, D.C. He was trained by this group called Canvas, which is a partnership with this corporate CIA called Stratfor that, you know, went down and taught Guaido and other young people like himself of how to overthrow governments. He was part of the very violent warimbas or blockades that took place in 2014 that caused the deaths of many innocent people, including burning people alive just because they looked like they were a Chavista, including putting wire across the street so that people on motorcycles would ride by and get decapitated. I mean, really brutal, gruesome things that this guy was a leader. He was out there in front of these things. And so he's backed by the United States. As soon as he announced, it was like it was already the United States immediately recognized him. Canada recognized him. European countries recognized him. It's now 50 countries that, because of U.S. pressure, have recognized Guaido. And it's just ridiculous. It makes them look like fools because nobody in their right mind could say that this guy is president. In fact, just the other day, Elliot Abrams was questioned by the press about how Guaido was in power. And Elliot Abrams had a really hard time explaining it. And in fact, you know, when the press asked questions, Abrams just looked dumber and dumber because he was, you know, because the press were like, well, what do you mean? You know, and Elliot's like, well, you know, his power will start when Maduro leaves. So he's in power, but he's not really in power yet. I mean, it's just like, he just looked like a fool. So, you know, the longer this goes on, the more ridiculous the United States and its allies look.
In our recent newsletter on popularresistance.org, we have an article about some of the falsehoods that this whole imperialist action is based on.
Yeah.
And we have a section on Guaido's being appointed as president and how it violates the Constitution in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. It's not even close to legitimacy about how he's appointed. It's totally the opposite of what the Constitution says as far as when a National Assembly president can become the president. So there's no basis for it. And what's been happening has been he's been embracing the United States. So he's more and more looking like the puppet that he is.
Yeah.
He's being investigated now for his ties to this electrical outage. He's being investigated for taking money from foreign sources, which is not allowed when you're a member of the National Assembly. At the same time, he's been, you know, calling for the military and being tied to this electrical outlet and being tied to the economic war. Maduro is doing the opposite. He's providing food. They're building housing. They built 3 million residences for the poorest Venezuelans in the last few years. That's 3 million people, average family of four. You're talking about 10 or 12 million people getting homes out of a population of 30 million people. providing food every month. I mean, it's like people can see. Mm-hmm. Guaido is for the American imperialists. Maduro mm-hmm. is for the Venezuelan people. And that's mm-hmm. the choice. And so Maduro's getting more popular. The opposition's getting less popular.
If I could just quickly add, one of the meetings that we had while we were there was with the president of the National Electoral Council, and that is actually one of their five branches of government. It's an independent branch, and her name is Tibisay Luceno, and she's just an amazing woman, longtime feminist. All the people that we met with in the government just were like amazing, down-to-earth, like real people. Mm. And she explained the whole electoral process to us in the last election and you know, answered our questions. And then at the end, she mentioned that there are a number of countries like the United States that are refusing to recognize the legitimacy of the election in 2018. Mm-hmm. And so she wants to go to the United Nations to provide the evidence to defend the legitimacy of that election. The United States sanctioned her, so she can't travel. They sanctioned her for degrading democracy.
Her whole career has been building democracy.
Right. And, wow. Yeah, and so she can't go to the UN and, mm-hmm. in the United States, and Switzerland is complicit with this, so she can't go to Geneva either. And this is really a travesty. This is terrible that the United mm-hmm. States is going to these, you know, disingenuous lengths of sanctioning yeah. this woman.
Now, where were you guys when you were in Venezuela? I know, you know, people have concern about, in this country, there's a lot of propaganda, so it's hard to get information out. So people are concerned that there's chaos, there's, you know, mass demonstrations for the opposition and poverty and chaos. So where were you guys and what did you see?
Well, I'll start. We were in Caracas. We didn't get a chance to go other places. However, one of our members, Eva Bartlett, has stayed for an extra couple of weeks. Okay. And she intends to travel around the country a little bit more. And folks can follow her on Facebook and see what her reports are. We spoke to a lot of government people, but we also met and we spoke with some opposition people. And we tried in two occasions when they announced demonstrations, opposition demonstrations, to go to these demonstrations. One happened after just about everybody else was gone, and I was still there. And we heard that there was this opposition demonstration that was going to, which everybody assumed was going to be a provocation, because they were going to march from a square in Caracas through a Chavista area, which was just a provocative move, go to the National Assembly building, which is also where the Constituent Assembly meets, and the thought was that they might try to take it over. Mm. And the reason that they thought this is because there's in Geneva also, in the next couple of days, convening the a Human Rights Commission. And they thought that perhaps there'd be tear gas or scenes of people being attacked by the police or something like this. And so this was the plan. So we first went to the square where they were supposed to start the march. We took the subway there. It was very interesting because the subways are nice. But they're also free. You just walk onto the subways and you go where you want to go. So we went to the square and we saw large numbers of police. But what was interesting was there were brigades of women police, you know, in formation, and they were kind of standing in the front. Mm-hmm. And so we asked, well, why are there so many women police that are put up in such a prominent position? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, when we expect a provocation, we find that the women are better at lowering the level of confrontation. So this is the way they were preparing, to suppress them in any way, but to try to lower the level of confrontation. And there's other ways they do this. We should talk to you about these things called vertical gyms, which would be very interesting. I don't know if Margaret was there when we heard this.
She wasn't.
But it's a very interesting one. In any case, they never showed up. So I was with one other person, Eva Bartlett, from our delegation, and we decided to walk the route they were going to go to see if we could come in contact with anybody or see anybody. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a regular day out in the streets. Everybody was doing shopping and running around and with their kids and buying ice cream or doing what people do. And we walked all the way to the National Assembly, which was 6 subway stops. It was a long walk. Mm-hmm. And we didn't see anybody in the way. But when we got there, there were a bunch of Chavista people around. They had a little tent up and they were trying to talk to people and things. And then there was this group of well-dressed people, about 30 of them. And so we tried to talk to them and see, are you the demonstration? And they were the demonstration. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a picture of that. And you see how these people look and how few there are. And then there's a bunch of people just kind of lounging around watching them. And those are mostly Chavista supporters, not in any way being threatening, just trying to see what was going on. Mm-hmm. But then very amazing, and we did talk to these people. And I want to tell you about the difference between talking to a Chavista supporter and talking to an opposition supporter, because I think this is the basis of the conflict. But I just want to first tell you what happened next.
Okay.
When we went to one of the big Chavista demonstrations, we noticed a number of people on like motorcycles and motorbikes. And we were told that there's a group that comes together on motorcycles and motorbikes to support Maduro and to support the Bolivarian Revolution. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they arrived in gigantic numbers. Again, if you go to the Facebook page, you'll see, you know, just for blocks, as far as you could see, the whole block filled with these motorcycle people who were coming to the National Assembly because they also heard that there was the possibility of going to try to take over the National Assembly. Mm-hmm. So these people were coming to protect the National Assembly, not to harass anybody, but to protect mm-hmm. the National Assembly. But it didn't have to happen. And the police handled these opposition people with kid gloves. Mm-hmm. They brought them behind a barricade where they stood around in a circle and made some kind of proclamation with out of sight of just about everybody. And that was the demonstration. That was the second demonstration in Caracas while we were there that they called, that that some people from our group tried to go to, and that it didn't materialize.
But Joe, contrast that to the demonstration we went to that was anti-imperialist.
Yeah, so the anti-imperialist.
That was massive.
It was just a sea of red as far as
you couldn't see the beginning and end. It was so long.
You couldn't see it just went for blocks, this direction, backward, forward.
100,000 plus people.
Celebrating in the streets. People were dancing and supporting and chanting. It was very, very interesting. But here's what I noticed. When you spoke to an opposition supporter, they typically would say something like, well, there's not opportunity. You can't go out and you can't buy things and all this kind of stuff. We want to go to America, the land of opportunity, and we want to be able to become rich too, you know? I mean, it was that kind of mentality. Mm. But it was basically about them, what they do to advance themselves. When you talk to a Chavista supporter, they talk to you about how people who didn't have housing have been given housing, how people who didn't have food have food, how they have free transportation. You could get gas for your car for free or for your motorbike for free. You just go in and you get it. And how the whole society is being lifted up for the first time. Education is free and college is free. And this is a country that's being sanctioned and having very, very difficult times financially right now, but they make the priority the people who are the most needy. And that really pisses off the wealthy and the middle class, which is the base of the opposition. So this concept of me versus us, and that's really the real concept of socialism versus capitalism. And I think that's the debate that's happening in this society, and it's being played out on the streets and with these demonstrations and the blackouts and everything that's happening.
Yeah. And
We were in Caracas the whole time, but we did go to different parts of Caracas. So we did go to the barrio, mm-hmm. one of the biggest barrios. It's 1.5 million people. It's called Katia. And we were taken on a tour by some of the people there. They showed us how they had, they're doing their own food production there. They're reproducing rabbits. They want every family to have rabbits that they can, grow for meat. They call it protein. And then they also have greenhouses and compost areas. And they last year produced 17 tons of fresh produce. And when we talked to the people there, we said, well, are you, you know, how bad is it? Are you starving? And the women started laughing, and they're like, no, we need a diet. We need more exercise. So, you know, and when you look around, you know, all the babies were chubby and kids looked healthy. You didn't see any homeless. I was looking for homeless and couldn't find them. But they are struggling because of the economic war that the United States is waging. They are growing food everywhere they can grow food. There's a whole Ministry of Urban Agriculture that's working particularly with youth, and we visited one of their gardens and talked to them. People who I met on the streets showed me photos of their balcony gardens and how proud they were of what they were growing on their small spaces on their balconies. But the prices of goods are very high there because the United States has artificially raised the value of the dollar compared to the bolivars. And so it's hard, you know, people do struggle to pay for things. And then medications is a real issue there. And Alfred Dzaias, who's the former head of the United Nations Human Rights Commission, did a report, I think it was last summer, and basically said that the economic war, which is causing them to not have the medications and the medical equipment that they need, is actually in violation of international law. It violates the Rome Statute. And so we met with the previous health minister, who's now in charge of procurement, and his name is Henry Ventura, and he showed us these graphs and how the units of medication per person in the country has fallen to about 20% of what it was before this economic war. So literally on television at night, during the news shows between the stories, they'll flash these little things that have a person's name, the medication that they need, and their phone number. So if somebody has extra, they can, you know, contact that person and share with them the medication that they have. They're trying to find ways around these issues. And then just last night, Maduro did a big announcement about how he's opening up more pharmaceutical manufacturing factories in Venezuela. They used to have quite a few, 58 of them, but because they weren't able to get the precursors because of the sanctions, that had fallen down, but now he's ramping that back up. So they're really trying to do what they can to get around the impacts of the economic warfare. Mm-hmm. And while they're, you know, they're very resilient and they're holding out, we should not have any illusion that this is, you know, not causing hardship for them. It is causing significant hardship for them.
Let me just make one point about this neighborhood, this barrio that Margaret mentioned, that really, I think, crystallizes why these people hate U.S. imperialism, hate the oligarchs, and will not go back to that. Mm-hmm. This barrio of 1.5 million people was not on the maps of the city of Caracas because no public services were going there before Hugo Chavez was elected. Mm-hmm. It was not even on the map. These were treated as if they didn't even exist, these people, 1.5 million of them. Now they have their own, you know, their own community councils and collectives and cooperatives building their own food. They have transit. They have healthcare. They have doctor on every block is the way they approach healthcare. And in the old days, they were non-people. They didn't exist.
And now they register to vote. And if you have any sense of
that's a good one.
In this country who hates the idea that poor people could vote, it's the same there. And it really gets under the skin because now these people can vote.
Yeah, the woman who leads the electoral council told us when she came in, 20% were not registered to vote. Now only 4% are not registered to vote. When she came in, we're not
eligible
adequate
voters.
Machines.
Wow.
We're not adequate machines in various precincts.
Or people might have had to walk too far.
Yeah, so they keep – a key foundational difference – between the U.S. and Venezuela is we don't have a right to vote in our constitution. They do. When you have a right to vote, that means the government has to make that right when you can actually have. You
exercise.
Can actually function and exercise. Mm-hmm. And so that means register people. That means make machines available. That make sure your votes are counted accurately. And I'll just tell you one thing that the Venezuela electoral system does that no other country in the world does that makes their electoral system better than anyone in the world. Mm-hmm. On election night, they do what's called a citizens audit, where a public audit, they have machines, they have electronic machines, but they also have a paper record. The voter looks at the paper record and puts it in the ballot. At the end of the night, they do a citizens audit where 53% of machines of every precinct are randomly selected. And then they have an audit that's open to the public, that the opposition, all parties can see, that the media can see. They take a paper out of the ballot box, read it, show it to everybody, and they count it. They go through every vote for half the machines and look for discrepancy between the electronic and the paper record. If there's no discrepancy, they trust the machines. If not, they do a hand count. No other country in the world does that. The U.S. resists audits. The U.S. resists recounts. There, they do it proactively to make sure people can have confidence in their vote. There's no possible way for there to be fraud in the voting system in Venezuela, because every person comes in, there's a fingerprint that starts the process, and there's a fingerprint that ends the process. And so everyone, they know every vote is legitimate, and they count every vote with a paper ballot and an electronic ballot.
And that's what's interesting when you hear our news media talking about the election in May of 2018. It's all vague. There's no details, no specifics. So, and
there's
then
no hearing
all this, there's nothing. There's none of the grounds met for self-appointing.
Well, there were 150 international election observers for that election. Those election observers just wrote the EU last week to say the EU, we unanimously concluded that this was a fair election that was trustworthy. And you put out a press release that says the opposite. Your press release is fanciful. It's not based on fact. The facts are this was a reliable election. So that's what the 150 plus international election observers are telling the EU about their lies.
Wow. And the scary thing is, with we're talking about that, you know, the masses are doing better now under, you know, starting with the Chavez government and now under the Maduro government. So the masses are doing better, but, you know, there's no denying the sanctions are hurting the people, but that's our sanctions and our pressuring of other nations. But I guess it was just a few days ago, Trump meeting with Bolsonaro, and he was talking about that we need to strengthen the sanctions. I don't even know what that means. What is there left to do?
There's a couple of things.
Yeah.
First of all, that meeting is a very dangerous meeting because, as we know, the first Latin American country to join NATO, to become a NATO partner, is Colombia, which is used as a staging ground for the U.S. aggression against Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Now, when NATO started its big expansion to the east in Europe, something agreed with Russia, with the Soviet Union when they dissolved, that we would not do, that we would not go into the former Soviet states with NATO, and we would not go into the allied states of Soviet Union. Now we're in 11 of them there. But it started with the bombing that took place in Yugoslavia, and the anniversary of that is coming up actually on the 24th. In a couple of days, and there will be a demonstration at noon at the United Nations to commemorate it by the Yugoslav community in New York. But that was used as a way to expand NATO in the eastern part of Europe. And the fear is, and this meeting with Brazil, is that that's maybe what they're trying to do in Latin America also. And that would be a very scary thing. However, you need to understand the sanctions. Sanctions are not just that they can't get goods. Mm-hmm. We have stolen their wealth.
Right.
For instance, they have the Citgo oil company, which is there, and they also have refineries in the United States. We've taken those. They had huge accounts in Citibank in New York. Citibank froze those accounts, billions and billions of dollars. All countries that have massive amounts of gold, the standard that they do with that gold is they keep the resources in the Bank of London. The Bank of London has frozen their gold reserves. They are the third biggest producer of gold in the world, and they have the first largest oil reserves of any country in the world. Mm-hmm. So they have $1.3 billion that they don't have access to. In fact, hundreds of billions of dollars of their wealth they do not have access to. And this becomes the pressure that has led to some of the hyperinflation that we've seen there, and that has caused serious problems. So we've basically stolen their wealth, and the sanctions are part of that. So when they try to do trade with a country that is following the sanction regimen that the United States has laid out, they can't do trade because you can't write a check to them that will go through a bank in their country, because the bank in their country cannot give money or take money from them.
Yeah.
And so that trade doesn't work. So it severely affects their economy in very, very many ways. It's just fortunate that there are a number of countries that are not abiding by the sanctions, such as Russia and China and Iran and South Africa and India and others.
Turkey.
Turkey. And the other thing is, although they have big reserves of oil, it's very thick oil. And to really move that oil, it has to be mixed with thinner oil. And the U.S. is stopping people from providing that kind of oil. So it's making even their oil industry very difficult for them to function with. So it's hurting the government in many, many ways.
Just and that's the intention.
One more thing on the NATO thing. The NATO thing, I'm sorry to keep on talking here. We all know also that NATO is coming to Washington, D.C. on the 30th. And we are holding a demonstration there across from the White House at 1 o'clock in Lafayette Park. And I urge people to come. If you go to the website no2nato2019.org, you can hook up with some of the transportation that's going down there. It's very important. We've made a focus of this because NATO, I believe, in this meeting, will plan out their expansion in Latin America and plan out their coordinated attack against Venezuela. It's a very, very serious thing. And so Hands Off Venezuela is going to be a focus of that. And it's very, very important that we oppose this right now, because they've said Venezuela is first and Nicaragua is second and Cuba is third. Mm-hmm. And they're going after the countries that have the oil to try to starve countries that don't have a lot, like China. And it's going to create a whole strategy that the imperialists are having for a serious move in terms of world dominance, as they are having difficult times with even small countries like Afghanistan. So it's very important that at this point that we oppose that and urge people to come to these actions.
To come out to DC on March 30th. And I'll drop later a link for in North Jersey, and then also we'll have a bus leaving early in the morning on Saturday, March 30th from Newark, and it will stop at New Brunswick. We'll drop a link on this feed later, because I know there are seats available and cost should not be a problem. So for anybody who cannot afford the suggested donation, there are a good amount of people who have donated. I know Venezuela is going to be a major part of the March 30th. Hands Off Venezuela will be incorporated into the No NATO action on March 30th. And Brazil is now looking to join NATO, which I'm wondering, at their meeting, are they going to discuss changing their name? It's the North Atlantic Treaty. So I don't, or they're going to have to change the, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work. Yeah.
Well, we're doing plugs. We're also doing a national webinar on March 28th, and that's going to be on NATO and Latin America. One of the speakers is from Colombia, and he's an expert in U.S. military bases and NATO in Colombia. So if you go to popularresistance.org and look at the events page or our Facebook page, you'll see the information for how to register for that. But that's just to give people more information. So, you know, when you come down on March 30th, you understand, you know, what's going on and what the connections are.
And for those who can stay, there's going to be a series of events from March 30th to April 4th. We just found out today on April 4th, which is, by the way, the anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King and the anniversary of his very important Beyond Vietnam speech that came out against the triple evils of militarism, capitalism, and racism. Mm-hmm. on April 4th, there'll be a meeting at the State Department where there'll be protests against the NATO meetings and against the NATO expansion. We're very concerned about Brazil and Colombia, which are both on the border of Venezuela. So that's the positioning is not coincidental.
Absolutely. And so we heard Trump talking about strengthening sanctions. We know that they attempted, or they actually were successful in shutting off the electric grid. What could the U.S. try to do next?
Oh, boy.
I don't know.
I mean,
we've also seen assassination attempts against Maduro.
Right. So, as we mentioned, while we were there, the U.S. diplomatic staff were expelled from the country, and that's because they were literally working with the opposition and meeting with members of the military, trying to bribe them, to go against Maduro. It largely didn't work. There was a small group of military that, you know, defected, and they went to Colombia, and they actually got abandoned in Colombia. The Colombian government is not supporting them and is kicking them out, so they're stuck. But what's worrisome is the possibility of paramilitaries coming in from other countries like Colombia, trying to create conflict and events that could be used to try to justify intervention. What's a good sign so far is that even allies of the United States are not supporting U.S. military intervention, including members of the Lima group like Brazil, and then also members of the European Union that are just saying that's too far. You know, you can't go in that direction. But the people of Venezuela are prepared for any kind of possibility. Maduro has been telling them to make sure they have batteries and water and a stock of food because nobody knows what the U.S. Could try to do.
Venezuela is prepared. They will not give in to U.S. imperialism. They want peace. President Maduro said he wants to have a meeting with Trump. Trump has refused so far. They've met with Bolton. The foreign secretary has met with John Bolton. Wasn't very fruitful. They tried. They want peace. They are prepared for conflict if they need to. They're going to protect their independence. They have a military of 200,000. And since Trump announced 2 years ago that military action was possible, they have built up their civilian militia, now over 2 million armed and trained. So that's 2 million plus 200,000 military on top of that National Guard and police. And so that I told Colonel Ann Wright that, and people may know she's an activist who has a long experience in, as a colonel in the military and also in the State Department. And she said that that's bigger than the U.S. military.
What is that? Could you imagine a dictator deciding to give arms to the people?
Yeah, right.
That's absurd.
One of the most interesting and impromptu meetings that we had was after we met with Maduro, which is something we haven't really discussed, which was just a fascinating meeting. After we met with Maduro, we walked out of the presidential palace and so forth where we met with him. And outside, there is an occupation that had been going on for about 2 weeks. And different groups come and occupy. And what they're doing is they're there to defend Maduro and the government against any attackers, whether it's the right wing in Venezuela or whether it's the United States and outside attackers. So when we were there, we walked in and, you know, unannounced, and it was the oil workers that were there. And they had a leader of the oil workers was speaking. And then each of us kind of spoke to just, you know, a very emotional thing, to chants and cheers and support from all these people. And then one guy got up and spoke very emotionally and so forth. And, at the end, he and I hugged each other. And he said to me, there's something else you should know. We're not just oil workers. We are armed oil workers. They're preparing for whatever is necessary.
And by the way, this is not just Venezuela. Yeah. Russia has said stay out. China has said stay out. Russia and China are partnering with Venezuela in both their oil and gold because they're trying to pick up the slack that was left by the United States economic war. They've loaned Venezuela money. So if Venezuela is attacked, U.S. is attacking China and Russia as well. And so this is a very serious issue. So people really should try to come down on March 30th. If they come down on the on April 4th as well, so yeah. Stay that time. That would be one thing we saw in Venezuela was solidarity among the people. Very strong solidarity among the people against U.S. imperialism. And I think that solidarity is something we should take to heart and show solidarity with them as well. The people, and even in the countries where the governments are following this foolish U.S. lead of recognizing this fake coup president, in those countries there are protests in support of Venezuela. So just because the leader says so doesn't mean the country feels that way.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, if they continue down this path, these countries that are supporting this fake coup president are going to pay a political price, because the people are not going to put up with a military coup or military or civil war created by the United States and Colombia and Brazil. They're not going to put up with it. And you'll see these governments losing power and being put out of office, because there are strong undercurrents in all of these countries that support Venezuela and are saying, hands off Venezuela. We did an earlier International Day of Action on February 23rd. There were protests all over the world in support of President Maduro and the Venezuelan government and against U.S. imperialism. So these countries, that's why they're saying no to military action, because they know there will be a political price for them to pay if they go wrong and a war begins in Venezuela. Everyone will know this war is a fake based on lies, based on intimidation. We've laid those lies out on our Popular Resistance newsletter. I'd urge people to read that and read the links, because we get so much misinformation that we need to be educated as a movement. We need to educate others, because that's where movements begin, is education. Educate on the facts and mobilize people for March 30th and April 4th.
I mean, that's one of the things that was so amazing in Venezuela, was the amount of political education people have at every level.
That's amazing.
And every person, from the person you meet on the street to the government official, it works in imperialism to their conversation. And, you know, it's just, and it's constant. It's like, you know, we're going to resist the imperialists. We see this imperialism. You know, we understand what's happening. It's a result of U.S. imperialism. There's just such a deep understanding. And we were guests of a TV show.
Amazing TV show.
One of the nights that we were there called Con el Mazo Dando. It's like beating with a club. And it was the host is Diosdado Cabello, and he is the president of the National Constituent Assembly. And it's a five-hour TV show.
Wait, that's just a five-hour weekly TV show. And it's the most popular show in Venezuela. 5 hours.
And it's and it's got funny little videos and things that the audience participates in, and he does political education. And he had over 80 like pieces of paper on bulletin boards that were different stories that he went through one by one.
He went through all 80 news stories.
Wow.
Deep political education.
Like, this is fake news.
5 hours.
This is good things that happened, bad things that happened. This was fake news. This is what happened with the electrical thing. Wow. And then he has these phrases that people will repeat. So they have, like, always loyal, never traitors, and all these things that people repeat. And it's just, it's the whole thing is political education, that people are getting this.
And they had the host had named each one of us and had us stand up and wave to the audience and to the cameras. And so, Joe, you'll know this is true, because Joe stands out with his fantastic Albert Einstein hair, the next day when we were in the streets, everybody knew who we were.
Well, you got it in the elevator, Joe.
Yeah, the waiters at the...
Everywhere. We were getting everywhere. People
everywhere. Saw
us. And we also did press conferences, so people got to know us.
Great.
And, you know, when I went to see this opposition demonstration, some people said, well, you shouldn't go, because everybody's going to know you. You know, people come up to us and have come up to us in the streets and at the demonstration want to take pictures with us.
We had so many pictures taken. Oh my gosh.
Process. And so we went to the demonstration, as I said, didn't really happen, although you know, the counteraction did happen. But it's clear that, you know, they wanted to put us up there, and they wanted to use it as a way to increase the political education of people and let them know that we are here. And Maduro just, you know, was very clear. He supports On the 23rd of February, he was driving in his car, and the Undersecretary of Foreign Affairs, this guy Carlos, who was with us a lot, was at the demonstration in New York. He's since been thrown out of the country, but he texted Maduro, and Maduro was driving his own car. Maduro held up his phone to his face and did a video of him giving his support to the demonstration on February 23rd, and thanking the people of New York for coming out, and
then tweeted
it out.
We told him about March 30th, and that the Boston Bus Drivers Union was going to send a bus down for the protest on the 30th. And Maduro began his career as a bus driver, got involved in the union, got involved in politics, got involved with Hugo Chavez, became the foreign minister, which is like the Secretary of State, and then became president. But he said, I'd love to drive that bus down to that from Boston to New York.
That would be great.
It was so funny.
He's also, by the way,
over a contract to be a baseball player at the Los Angeles Dodgers. Yeah. So he's an interesting guy.
That union, by the way, which is United Steelworkers Union, that organizes the bus drivers, it's local 8751, is paying for the bus.
That's right.
Asking people if they can to pay $30. If they can't, it's free for them. So they're trying to mimic. And that bus drivers union is very interesting because it is largely majority Haitian. And there's been a big connection between what's going on in Haiti and Venezuela. And there's so much racial overtones on this. People in Venezuela are African Venezuelan and indigenous and combinations of all that. And they're every color. It goes from deep, dark black all the way to Guaido. You know, it's every
even
single.
Even white.
Lily white.
And
so it's and so it has a racial connection and a class connection, and it can be a political education for people here too.
Well, there's like a 200-year history between Venezuela and Haiti because Simón Bolívar was there in Haiti when they got their independence, and
when they ended slavery and became the first independent nation in the Caribbean.
Yeah, and they then provided support to Bolívar to go to Latin America and help liberate Latin America, and they gave weapons and they gave military support and other things.
And so on the Venezuelan flag is also the symbol of Haiti.
Right.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So solidarity there to fight for independence.
And same thing with Chavez was in Haiti when they got rid of Baby Doc and brought in, elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Mm-hmm. And he was inspired by how they did that and thought he could go back to Venezuela and try to do the same thing. So there's very close ties between them and Haiti. Mm-hmm. Venezuela has helped Haiti out through a program called the Petrocaribe. And so there's just a very deep solidarity between those countries.
And in fact, the people may have noticed the most recent uprising in Haiti that's still ongoing. The president of Haiti, who was basically selected by Hillary Clinton.
He came in third.
He came in third in the election, but Hillary Clinton said he's the president. And they came out in support of the U.S. coup fake president, and the people of Haiti. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. There were a whole lot of other problems, but that was the issue that made them go to the streets. And there's an ongoing uprising now against that president.
Yeah.
So everyone, let's show our solidarity to Venezuela and learn more about why say no to NATO and come down to DC March 30th through April 4th. And do you guys have any closing words? I thank you all so much for your time. You all must be exhausted after your trip. But do you have any closing words for our viewers? What do we do? How do we...
Just say if between now and the 30th, if people can get on a bus or get in a car or get down there to do that. But if they're members of of organizations, I would urge them to start sending out some more information about it. Because when people get it from very different areas, they can see that it's really happening. And again, they can go to the website at no numeral2nato2019.org to get all the information they would need for any emailing. And there's also flyers there that they could send out, JPEGs of flyers and the transportation information.
Good.
And if people are interested in UNAC, they can go to the UNAC website, which is unacpeace.org, UNACPEACE.org.
Okay, for more information. Yeah.
One of our key tasks is to counter the misinformation that's going on around Venezuela. And so at popularresistance.org, we're posting regularly, you know, articles that people can use to educate themselves so they can counter the lies. We've done a number of newsletters on this. A number of weeks ago, we did one called What Activists Need to Know About Venezuela. And then this past weekend was really, you know, busting the lies that are being told about Venezuela. So go to popularresistance.org. Don't believe what you hear in the corporate media, but if you want to figure out what's really going on, and then share stuff out, because people need to have this information. And share on social media, like Joe said, about what's coming up on March 30th. There are about 1,000 people, close to 1,000 people out last weekend in D.C. for the Hands Off Venezuela March. We need to make that even bigger.
Absolutely. And people should also know about the takeover of the embassy in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
That's right. Just last night, there was our allies were protecting the Venezuelan embassy by staying in the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. to stop it from being taken over by opposition. Let me just say a couple quick points. One, our job, if everyone who sees this video goes to our websites and forwards articles about Venezuela, that is creating media. That is creating information that people need, because we are lied to in this country. And we need to come back against those lies with the truth. And we have the truth. It's available. It's online. And unfortunately, this is a bipartisan problem. Bernie Sanders' statements on Venezuela are terrible. He puts out the lies about a dictator, authoritarian, killing nonviolent all lies.
Yeah.
Everything he said was a lie.
Yeah, that's supporting the Trump rhetoric.
Every progressive Democrat, except I think Tulsi Gabbard's the only one who's got it right. Everybody else has got it wrong. So even progressive Democrats need to be pressured and educated. They need to know that the public knows the truth and can see through their lies. Because some of these people are running for president. And we can't have liars as president. We can't have people who are misinformed and believing this propaganda or spreading lies. Either one is unacceptable. So our job is to educate ourselves, educate others, and share the information widely to let them know that we know the truth.
Absolutely. And it's Democratic primary season. So if you are, hold your heroes accountable. Right.
Well, remember, there is an anti-imperialist party. It's called the Green Party.
Absolutely, that's what I am. So I'm not participating in the imperialistic.
We have four greens right here.
Republican
four greens right here.
Yes. Yes. So if they're your heroes, then you better hold them accountable. Call them out, because except for Tulsi Gabbard, they're all just repeating the Trump rhetoric. And that's okay when it comes to Venezuela. It's ridiculous.
Well, it was the Obama rhetoric before the Trump rhetoric, so.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. Like I said, I know you guys must be exhausted, so rest up. And I know I will see all of you on March 30th. Is everybody going to be?
Yep.
We'll be there.
Okay, good. And just a little shout to our viewers, if you could help us continue to run, go to njrevolutionradio.com. There's a donation link, so please, so we can help counter the propaganda that's out there. Any small amount will do. And thank you guys again so much for your time, and have a good night, everybody.
Thank you
all very much.
Before we head in to the main panel for tonight, I was just playing a clip of when New Jersey Revolution Radio first started, when I was in my car. And, I'm talking into this thing. And the reason why I remember saying it is because I just kind of lost my mind. And I just said, John Bolton is a fucking lunatic. Like, who's listening to this guy? Why would anybody put this man in power? And for some reason, This guy who's just been really nothing but a warmonger. Nothing. It just seems to really like war. I can't get a grip on anything else about this man other than his passion
for war, death, and destruction.
It's sick.
And yeah.
What kind of world are we living in that this guy keeps finding his place in? And I thought this was done, honestly, after the Iraq debacle. You would think that anybody associated with that would never be taken seriously again. Yeah, here we have convicted war criminal Elliot Abrams. We're doing his thing in South America again. John Bolton wants to start with the right word. And then on top of those two things, and I know most of the media has been on Iran, but, you know, the situation is very grave with Venezuela, as you know from being down there, as our comrade Kevin Zeese is about to tell us. And it's almost like we're ignoring the fact that we're blockading North Korean ships, too.
So much.
That's like a minor thing now. Our foreign policy is so over the top, violent and incomprehensible that we're actually not even noticing when we stop North Korean ships from delivering coal supplies as part of an embargo. It's crazy.
And the mainstream media is not reporting on it. So
they're not. Money, Kevin, Bahman, thanks for joining us tonight. I love all you guys. I tried to cue up some of Money's songs, but I didn't want to scare everybody away at the beginning of the interview. But maybe I'll try and cue up something for the end, man. All right.
Okay. So, for the exit. Okay.
I'm going to drop off and thanks for coming. We're going to have a great panel here tonight.
Okay. So thank you for joining us this evening. So I'll just run through the intros for our viewers who aren't familiar with all of your familiar faces. So we have Kevin Zeese, co-director with Popular Resistance. We have Bahman Azad, director of New Jersey Peace Council. And we have Money with the band Race Trader, who's also going to talk about... I'm sorry? Iranian peace. Okay, sorry about that. So, thank you so much for joining us this evening. And gosh, where to start? As we just did that rundown, there is so much. I'm just going to grab right now. We're going to start with a little bit of Venezuela. And Kevin.
You are one of our brave
embassy protector collective members. Thank you so much for, was that 37 days that you were in the embassy? And tell us, how many people were with you when you started the collective?
Well, it really changed a lot as it progressed. When we started, we were free to come in and come out. And so people came and worked during the day. Some stayed for the night. We had forums every night. About 100 people showed up at those forums on AFRICOM, on the threats with Iran, with Honduras, Venezuela. We even had a great forum with John Kiriakou, a former CIA officer. He gave a session on regime change from the inside, from the view from a CIA agent. So that's pretty amusing to be in an embassy under the threat of U.S. coup and have a CIA agent talking about coups.
Yeah.
So the people came in and out for that. That was a very fluid situation. We had up to 70 people staying some nights. This is a large four-floor embassy. 80 people worked there, and people were sleeping in offices. So some nights we had people doubling up in offices because we were too full. It gradually declined for various reasons. It went on longer than we expected. People had, you know, personal issues and professional issues. They had health issues. They had family issues and left for those reasons. In addition, after Guaido did his attempted military coup, his third coup attempt that failed, there were large numbers of pro-coup opposition people that the Secret Service allowed to surround the building to terrorize us. They assaulted people. They showed their racism, their misogyny against women. They made sexual assault threats and even murder threats. Yeah. Just amazing how they were banging on the door, shaking the building, trying to get in. The Secret Service let that happen rather than protect the embassy. In fact, there were several break-ins. And two people that were discovered by the police were not arrested. They went out and got pats on the back and did selfies with their opposition friends out there, their pro-coup friends out there. So they just kind of get licensed to try and terrorize us to get us to leave voluntarily. We gradually got down to four people, but we did that in some, for some strategic reasons. About 2 weeks before we were finally forced out, the electricity was turned off, the water was turned off, food was being blockaded. And so we wanted to conserve our resources, and we cut the number of people down to something like 17. Then we cut it down to something like 10. Two nights before we left, the three people left voluntarily, three embedded media. So we were down to four people at the end who were prepared to stay for another couple months. We had a good food supply, a good water supply. We were prepared to stay for a while. We were rationing our food and water. And the police decided they couldn't take it any longer and decided to violate the Vienna Convention, illegally enter the embassy, trespass on an inviolate area that violated the international law, illegally evicted us and arrested us. And so now we're facing criminal charges, which we're looking forward to challenging, facing in court, because we're going to turn that against the government, put the government on trial rather than us on trial, because the government's actions were actually horrendous. They failed to protect the embassy, and they violated the Vienna Convention.
Yeah, and I know you might not be able to talk to us too much about the pending court matter, but do you have dates at this time? Are you going to be looking for people to come down and show support at the courthouse? What's going on with that?
Well, we just heard today our first court date, which is only a status conference. It's a meeting to discuss what the status of the proceedings are, was just changed from June 12th until next Thursday. We have actually assigned the chief judge, the chief district court judge. I think she took the case herself. I'm not sure whether that's good or bad news. So we'll have our first status conference that day. We have a lot to go before it gets to trial. Okay. We have a lot of discovery that we want to achieve. I'm sure there'll be some fights about that with the government trying to hide information from us. And so we have a good legal team. We have four defendants. Each of us have our own lawyers. We'll have a joint defense agreement so we can work together, but also have individual representation. It's going to be a very strong legal team. And I think we're going to do, I'm really looking forward to the trial. I think we have a really great chance of putting the government on trial here.
Okay. And you'll be updating through Popular Resistance and other social media entities for when you need people to come
show
down
up
and show up and giving us updates.
And we're going to be organizing days of action in D.C., international days of action and national days of action to kind of escalate our efforts to stop this U.S. coup.
Yeah.
We're going to build toward a event September 21st, in the International Day of Peace, when the U.N. General Assembly is meeting in New York City. Okay. We expect to have a very large event during that, probably in the tens of thousands of people. We're going to be trying to put on the agenda the issue of this Venezuelan coup, as well as threats to Iran and to Nicaragua, Cuba, and other countries, and really calling for an end to this kind of regime change policy. We want to create a situation where no 2020 candidate can endorse this Venezuelan coup, and that the end of U.S. empire is put on the agenda to be discussed. Because empire is failing, it's going to end. I think it's time for presidential candidates and other candidates to start talking about how we responsibly end empire, how we close foreign bases abroad, how we bring troops home, how we change the military budget so that rather than taking 60% of discretionary spending, it's down to 25% and less of discretionary spending. We don't need that military we have. It's way overspent, overlarge, overly aggressive. And we're going to use this Venezuela effort to make that an issue in the 2020 campaign.
Absolutely. And let me just step back a moment. You said September 21st, International Day of Peace. Are these actions going to be in D.C.?
That'll be in New York City.
New York City.
That action will be in New York City at the U.N. General Assembly.
Okay.
The International Day of Peace is actually a U.N.-designated day. Okay. That wasn't our name. That was the name for U.N. gave that day. And it just coincides with the General Assembly meets. We want to do while the General Assembly meets, we want foreign ministers to comment on U.S. behavior. I think it's time for the U.S. to be really isolated for its regime change operations, its extreme military spending, its unilateral coercive measures, which we call sanctions. which are illegal under international law, and the U.S. threats of military attacks. These are just unacceptable behaviors, and it's time for the world to stand up to the United States.
Absolutely. Okay. So I'm putting that in my calendar, and I know there's going to be more info and more events, because in this, you know, this administration, but whether it be a Democratic administration, we've been on the path of hyper-aggressive foreign policy. So the people have to act. People have to hold their politicians accountable, your U.S. senators, your representatives. I know on March on the Pentagon is organizing for an event in October. And
that's
on
right.
their website, there is a declaration you can sign on to that is about seeking to end the endless wars. So I would tell people to go to the March on the Pentagon website, and there's going to be an action in October. So we're going to have actions in September, and I'm sure there's going to be actions in between, because, yeah, it doesn't look like this is ending anytime soon enough. And so Iran, we had some heating up going on with Mr. Tweeter. I guess we could start with Bahman Azad with New Jersey Peace Council. And what is your take on what's been going on with the heating up of pumping up the incidents that have been taking place over the past week with the U.S. Embassy in Iraq and about the Navy ships in the Gulf and what's going on there? So, Bahman?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Well, this thing has been going on for a long time, but in fact, since the Iranian Revolution, that has been the case. Iran has been under sanction and pressure, and the regime change policy off and on has been put on the table. Probably, I would say the beginning of the process of intensification of this effort to push for a regime change in Iran, although for a long time it was being called for, was the defeat of the United States in Syria in terms of bringing down Assad government. Because not only that was a huge retreat and a defeat for the plan for regime change in Syria, but with the alliances that were created as a result of that between Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, and then Russia, this process, in fact, gave rise to the emergence of what is everybody calls now resistance front in the Middle East, consisting of those four. And with the fact that the Syrian government is more and more gaining additional areas and pushing back the terrorist organizations and mercenaries, I think this has scared the Saudis, this has scared the Israelis, and scared the United States, because this could easily shift the balance of forces in the Middle East. And now with Reagan and with Trump coming in, of course, with this belligerent policy and the type of advisors and secretaries that he has around him, and especially Bolton, who was actually the original figure in pushing for regime change in Iran, this has intensified, and they think they are able, through pressure, through extreme economic sanctions after the removal, withdrawing from the nuclear treaty, nuclear agreement. They are going on the path of choking Iranian economy on the one hand in the hope that they can create some kind of uprising, mass uprising in the country by crippling Iranian economy, and through that possibly their military forces. And also with these threats of war on Iran. Of course, it seems that the ruling class in this country is not totally sure about taking a direct military action. in Iran. For several reasons, because American people are sick and tired of war, as Kevin said. Mm-hmm. Secondly, economy cannot handle it. And thirdly, Iran is not Iraq or Syria.
That's right. That's right.
It's a country of about 80 million people. Mm-hmm. It's well advanced in technology,
yeah,
in social relationships. It has a highly educated population. Mm-hmm. Although they have problems with the Iranian government in terms of various aspects of its affairs, mm-hmm, Iranians have proven that they, like Venezuelans, they're ready to defend their country at any cost.
That's right.
And in that sense, the chances of launching an attack on Iran and coming out of it, without any huge cost for them, is not would not be easy. Besides, it would put the whole region into up in flames. It's not going to be limited to Iran alone. Mm-hmm. It will immediately become a regional, mm-hmm, war. And beyond that, it could directly involve two nuclear superpowers around the world. And mm-hmm, that could be another area of confrontation that many people are not willing to take a chance with. So whether it's really bluffing or at this moment the threats and all that, mm-hmm, is not clear, but they have a multi-phase plan. Mm-hmm. The economic sanctions, isolating Iran, propaganda campaigns, lots of things that they have done with regime change policy before, and in the hope that they can bring Iran to its knees. If they cannot, then probably they will provoke some kind of false flag operation and use that as an excuse to start some kind of military operation. Everybody is really worried about what is being on and going on, because we are not dealing with rational people here at all.
Yeah.
And that makes it very dangerous.
Yeah.
These guys are crazy.
Yeah, as Brian was saying earlier, between Bolton and, Pompeo and, the tweeter in chief could escalate just because of these bizarre tweets he's doing.
Military action supplemental budgets are approved. And that $700 billion budget doesn't include the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the nuclear weapons program. We put in place, both Obama and Trump have been pursuing a $1 trillion upgrade of nuclear weapons. And so it's even bigger than that $700 billion, which is over 60% of federal discretionary spending. And NATO is so important. And we focused on this with the No Foreign Bases Coalition, because the U.S. cannot get the international approval it needs from the Security Council for its various wars. And so NATO is there to provide an imprimatur, a kind of a cover of international approval. Even though every NATO war has been an illegal war, that's their cover. They can't get the UN to approve the war. There's only two legal wars allowed: when you're attacked, mm-hmm, to defend yourself, and when it's approved by a Security Council. Mm-hmm. Every other war is illegal. And so NATO is critical to providing cover for U.S. wars.
Yes, they are building NATO as an alternative to the U.N., actually.
Exactly.
The conscious policy on the part of George W. Bush administration. Mm. And they have been ever since bypassing the United Nations, not just go unilaterally by NATO, through NATO. One thing I wanted to add is that for a period of time since at least 9/11, U.S. was preoccupied with the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And during that period, progressive forces in Latin America managed to gain a lot of ground.
That's right.
Now, U.S. is finding, kind of some free time from Middle East, generally, not two, three wars going on, and is kind of turning the attention back to the Latin America. Yeah. And what is going on, during all this time since the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO has been expanding eastward. Yeah. Towards Soviet Union and China. Mm-hmm. But now they're moving it westward. This is a shift in the policy. They are pushing NATO westward now. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly a threat that looms over the whole of Latin America. It's not just Colombia and Brazil, but it's going to engulf the whole region. God knows how many more bases are going to be created all over the place.
In South America. And essentially, NATO is the U.S.
Yes.
So it's just another way of spreading empire. So it's growing east, it's growing west, it's growing.
And this is all, by the way, going to be part of the failure of U.S. empire. Mm-hmm. It's spreading itself thin. I would give Barack Obama credit for Latin America being returned to U.S. domination. Under George Bush, they were focused on the Middle East, and Latin America didn't get any attention. President Obama was a very excellent empire president. Mm-hmm. Not only did he reverse the tide in Latin America, he really created the U.S. domination militarily of Africa. He also did the Asia pivot. And so President Obama was very effective at pushing U.S. military power, expanding NATO across the Russian border, the Asia pivot to challenge China, Africa, AFRICOM to get military domination of Africa, and reversing the pink tide in Latin America. He was a very excellent empire president. And even though he gets credit because he can smile well, he really was a very dangerous president. He also legitimized drone killing. Yeah. And he made that lawful. So he has a terrible record. Yeah. President Trump, on the other hand, is a pretty lousy empire president. But with President Trump, the failings of empire are more obvious. It's stretched so thin now. Obama spread it out so far globally.
Yeah.
And that's why the budget's so high, why it's undermining the U.S. economy, why the empire economy no longer works for people in the United States. This spreading the thin of Asia pivot, Africa, Latin America, Middle East, it's just not sustainable. And I think that the U.S. is burning itself out. And that's why I say it's our responsibility as activists to start to put into the political narrative, how do we end U.S. empire responsibly, the least damage to the world, and the least damage to the people of the United States.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, we're in the primary season, and I don't know what number are we up to, 23 candidates in the Democratic race right now. And, I guess Tulsi touches on things a little bit, but the majority of them really aren't touching foreign policy, or they're towing the line of the Trump administration, which is...
Well, the only candidate has been clear.
Yeah.
When we were in the Venezuelan embassy, was Howie Hawkins. He's running for the, he's doing an exploratory committee for the Green nomination.
Yes.
We hope he'll announce his candidacy soon. He put out three very strong blog posts on HowieHawkins.us about the Venezuela situation that were very clear on the impact of U.S. economic sanctions, which really are unilateral coercive measures that are illegal under international law.
Yeah.
Killing 40,000 people in Venezuela in the last 3 years. He's very clear on the violation of international law and how this really brings the United States back to the era of Genghis Khan. Mm. Since then, there's been respect for embassies. And of course, we've had the Vienna Convention since 1961. But this is a long-term reality in diplomacy that embassies are protected.
Absolutely.
And so we're now going back to the era of Genghis Khan. And Howie Hawkins has been the person who's been most clear on all these issues. So people urge people to go to HowieHawkins.us and see what he's written about this, because he's a very clear thinker on this.
Yeah,
and I think the peace movement should really demand that the issue of war and peace and military budget be part of every debate.
Yes.
Until elections.
Exactly. And it's our job to ensure that. We got to do that by our actions.
Yes.
I don't mean by supporting Bernie Sanders or Tulsi or even Howie. I mean by taking our action to the streets. And forcing this into the political narrative so it can't be ignored by the media or by the politicians.
Yes.
Okay. And just like to reiterate to our viewers that, we have these organizations like the No Foreign, No
Bases.
Raman, do you want to give the entire...
No U.S. Foreign Military Bases.
No U.S. Foreign Military Bases.org. And
no. Website is noforeignbases.org.
Noforeignbases.org. Sorry about that.
No problem.
And I know we have a really hard time getting accurate news about empire and our hyper-militarization. So we need to go to orgs like Popular Resistance to get real information and real news. And,
and the U.S. Peace Council.
And the U.S. Peace Council, so we can find out what's really going on And I was just going to ask, you know, what can we do? But I think we touched on it. Do either of you have anything else to say to our viewers about?
Yes. I mean, there's so much to do. And if you can't be occupying an embassy.
Thank you so much.
Which is a unique event in U.S. history. So I know not most people can do that.
Yeah.
But we have to be the media. That's the bottom line beginning.
Yeah.
The basis of all movements is education, and the complicity of the corporate media became evident on Venezuela with their lack of coverage of our stay in the Venezuelan embassy. You would think that this unique event in U.S. history, mm-hmm. never before have U.S. citizens gone into a foreign embassy to protect it from the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Would think that would be of some media value.
Yeah.
But instead, it was not covered. And it was not covered because if they were to cover it, they had to explain why we're there, which means that all their lies about Venezuela would become obvious.
Absolutely.
And so the first job of everybody listening is, and I appreciate your type of radio show because of this, is be the media. If you go to popularresistance.org, you can sign up for our daily digest. Mm-hmm. That will get you 10 to 15 articles in your mail every morning at 6 a.m. It'll be a paragraph about each article. You can select the articles that interest you and share them.
Share, absolutely.
Because you know that social media is being undermined by the corporations. Google and Facebook are doing their best to suppress us and other left advocacy groups.
Yes.
And so we need the people to be the media. Not only does the corporate media not cover these issues, or when they do cover, they cover it inaccurately, but the social media is being undermined. So it takes a concerted effort.
Yeah.
It is a supreme act of activism.
Yeah.
To be the media.
Be the media.
To build your media networks.
Absolutely.
So your social media becomes a news channel.
Yeah.
That is your job. Don't put up stuff about your cat, about the bird watching.
Food. Yeah.
Put up stuff or even your garden. I love gardens and cats and birds. Don't get me wrong.
I have a garden. But you got to do work.
You got to do work with the social media.
Absolutely.
And I would like to add one more element to this in addition, because Kevin didn't mention it, but he's involved in it directly. And the question is, we have to bring our forces together.
Yes.
Yes.
We cannot fight this on separate fights, on different separate issues, if we understand that the cause of all of these problems, be it war, be it economic hardship, poverty, unemployment, environment, all of that is the empire. And empire is the empire of racism too.
Absolutely.
That's right.
All of the attacks on people of color.
Yes.
All over the world. And internally.
Absolutely.
So all of our causes kind of lead to the same culprit, the same enemy.
That's right.
We have to bring our forces together to fight it. We cannot do it alone on a separate cause basis. Mm-hmm. They are linked and we have to fight for it.
Exactly right. And that's why the elections of these two corporate parties of millionaires and billionaires that protect Wall Street and war are not where we should put our effort. Even the best candidates in those two corrupt parties are a waste of our time.
Absolutely.
Our time should be spent building a movement and changing the political narrative. And we don't do that in either of these two corrupt parties. We have to break free of that and build an independent political movement that brings together economic, racial, and environmental justice, as well as peace and end of imperialism. And that's what we've been doing. That's what Popular Resistance is about. That's what the No Basis Coalition is about. These are coalition efforts. We call ourselves a collective in the Venezuelan embassy because we brought people together. We brought together some groups that were sometimes fighting against each other. They put aside their fights and worked together to stop the U.S. coup in Venezuela. So that's our job. Unite people, create solidarity, and build an independent political movement that really stands for economic, racial, and environmental justice, as well as peace.
It's all connected. So we have to unite the left, the real left. Thank you guys so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this special tribute to Kevin Zeese by New Jersey Revolution Radio. We offer our sincere condolences to all of his friends, family, and comrades, and we look forward to continuing his work with you.